This session, which is the last of the formal sessions, is on public interest, which is one of those elusive things that depends on whether you're talking about it from your own point of view or from somebody else's point of view. We'll start, if we may, with Rachel, and then Gavin, and then Andrew. We do have a time slot indicator here, but it's clearly ineffectual, so I shall be using a yellow card. Mark, 1 minute, and a red card, which means you leave the field. 15 minutes apiece, starting with Rachel.
Right, well, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. It's very nice to come back to Oxford. I'm going to talk a little bit about what may be seen as a missed opportunity or perhaps an appropriate response in the Leveson report to the argument by the press that there should be a statutory recognition of the importance of the public interest and that this should be a general provision that could apply across all particular fields. You might think that the press had real sort of chutzpah in putting this forward. I mean, this was an investigation into real failings on the part of the press, a real failure to understand what the public interest required of them in certain contexts. And here they are arguing for even more protection. And I think for that reason, it's possibly not surprising that they didn't actually have much traction in terms of the final report. But I think one shouldn't discount some of the concerns that are raised. And even if perhaps the general form of protection that they were seeking was not appropriate, and I think perhaps there's an argument that that wasn't the right response to the problem that they had identified, there are things that perhaps could be done and need to be done to ensure that where the press actually are acting in the public interest, they can do that without undue fear of legal repercussions. I think there are a number of reasons why one might be concerned about affording the press, particularly freedom to act in a way which is illegal, and one can see that very clearly from the facts that were the background to the Leveson report. There was a fear on the first count that this was really special pleading, that the press could in fact break the law with impunity, and we have a principle of the rule of law, and therefore it's inappropriate to offer special status to the press. On the other hand, there already is established protection for the press to cause harm, and I think Perry Keller's point is very much in point here. There are contexts in which we accept the press within a carefully regulated area might be allowed to cause harm. So the question really is not whether the press should be forced to comply with the rule of law, but the extent to which the rule of law applies and applies to certain forms of press behaviour. I think a second concern was that if you give the press a degree of freedom, they're likely to abuse it. And there was discussion earlier this morning about the way that perhaps protection of sources might be used in order to shield the press in context which would be inappropriate, so that there could, in fact, be some form of overextensive use. And I think also this idea of overextension crops up with the difficulties that we've already addressed during the course of the day in trying to define the limits of any regulatory system. And if we're extending our concept of journalist to bloggers and private individuals, we might feel slightly more uneasy about allowing these people to perhaps engage in what we would see as criminal behaviour. A nice example that one might give is the fairly recent case of Hayes against Willoughby, which was a Supreme Court case that involved harassment. And one of the exceptions in the Harassment Protection for Harassment Act concerns the course of conduct which is pursued for the purpose of preventing or detecting crime. And this was an individual who'd got his own particular vendetta and wanted to find out whether somebody else had actually been engaged in tax fraud or criminal activity and pursued them with ruthless tenacity over a number of years. The dissenting judge, Lord Reed, in this context, emphasised that if one closed down that protection for preventing or detecting crime, there was a risk that that could affect investigative journalism. So, you know, we might feel comfortable perhaps about mainstream media in certain cases with the kind of institutional controls that we've been talking about engaging this in activity. We might feel much less sanguine about it, perhaps, if carried out by individuals and lone bloggers who are taking it on themselves to follow investigations. So what I'm going to do is just say a few words about the public interest and then mention a number of contexts in which it arises. And I suppose the paper that I've submitted to you, which is one that's written with my co-author, Yolanda Stolter, who unfortunately can't be here today, is really, as I say, just very much a mapping exercise, but also I'll try and identify points at which the Leveson report has made some either suggestions or decided, in fact, that it's not necessary to act. I think the problem that we're talking about here is that the public interest has a number of different aspects to it. One is the substantive nature of the information, and I think we're familiar, many of us, from our own studies and experience, that there are categories of information that are treated as important for a democracy that are giving us information that enable us to make key decisions. And that this information not only has to be in relation to certain kinds of questions, but also may have to be of a certain quality. So for information generally to be objectively in the public interest, it must be accurate, and that goes back to the point that we were discussing this morning. It's not generally in the public interest to have misinformation about climate change or other matters. Secondly, there's a more longer-term institutional public interest, and that's that the media can carry on investigating in the future without being unduly chilled. And in that context, it might be that as a society we are prepared to accept harm, we're prepared to accept that the media might actually get something wrong or that they might engage in activity that's otherwise illegal because they thought that what they were doing was to identify something that was in the public interest. And that more long-term institutional interest of the press not to be chilled and to be able to carry out its activities is a very difficult one to weigh, and I think it's one that we have been grappling with. And I think, as I say, in the context of the report by Lord Justice Leveson, it was one that was very difficult for the press to make a good case for support. The public interest arises then in a number of different contexts, and I'll just quickly go through some of them. Editorial guidelines and regulatory codes. The key broadcasting organisations have established specific guidelines, Ofcom, the BBC with its editorial codes. Also the PCC, which, as we're discussing now, has been under review. If you look at these, they have already identified, I think, fairly well key aspects of what might be considered the public interest, and I put those in a chart in the paper, and you can see that there's considerable coherence. And I think linking up with Lara's points, I don't know if Lara's still here, about a degree of consistency, it could help the press if the regulators tried to ensure that where there are divergences, there aren't that many, but where there are divergences, there is a degree of consistency. The area where perhaps there is more inconsistency is in relation to the procedures, and one can accept that within different organisations, different procedures for dealing with cases where there might be a question of illegality in order to pursue an investigation that could be in the public interest. The question about how to deal with that will vary from one institution to another. But it's very clear that the PCC already, in its guidelines, indicates that it's important for the institution to keep very good notes and to record that it's identified that there could be a public interest issue in that and to make records of it. The BBC too, after the Hutton report, which of course is extremely conscious of these issues, also is much more specific in terms of the procedures. And Leveson, looking at this, suggested that there should be perhaps more clarity in relation to each of the particular code provisions, at least in relation to the PCC code, as to what the public interest might require in each of those particular situations, but also to ensure that these procedures are in place, as we've discussed this morning, across the institutions, and also possibly having an advisory system within the new regulator, which would enable the editor or whoever it is to make contact and actually discuss the public interest issue that could arise. In terms of the common law and the public interest, I'm not going to say too much about it. It's an enormous area. But in relation to the key concerns that I think perhaps face the press, defamation, we can already see the courts under the influence, in some ways, and perhaps preceded, at least with Reynolds, the Human Rights Act, but under the influence of European law, being sensitive in many instances to concerns about being able to, as a journalist, possibly publish something which is wrong, which is inaccurate, and still be protected on the basis that you've acted responsibly. So the development of a responsible journalist defence has already been established in relation to defamation. One question I think that was raised in the Leveson report was whether that should be extended further, and in particular whether it should be extended to the field of privacy. I don't know to what extent that this is a major issue, but certainly in relation to news gathering, possibly prior to publication, the media may be engaged in activities which are an invasion of privacy, other forms of possible blagging that one might classify as harassment or possibly against the Official Secrets Act, where the press might want to argue, but we thought that this was legitimate. As it stands at the moment, it's not clear whether it's possible in the context of privacy, and I welcome anyone who might be able to perhaps give further information on this, for the press to argue, well, we tried our best, we thought there was a real public interest here, but we got it wrong. In the Mosley case, it was recognised that the press initially thought there was a Nazi theme that was underpinning this. In fact, they hadn't got any plausible information for it, and that was discredited. But that would be the kind of case where you might suggest the press could have thought that there was some legitimate interest in invading Mosley's. There might have been invading Max Mosley's privacy. In that case, that they didn't have the grounds and they couldn't have made out a responsible journalist case. But there might be such cases. So we don't know quite how far the law is going to develop in that context. I think the area where it's most problematic has been in the field of the collection, particularly of statutory offences, in the criminal law field. And as I think Andrew is going to discuss, particularly in relation to bribery, the situation is that some acts have statutory defences, some acts don't have any statutory offences at all, and if they have statutory defences for the press, they often vary quite significantly in their wording and nature. Now, the Human Rights Act obviously imposes an obligation on the courts, wherever possible, to interpret legislation in line with freedom of expression. And the courts can go quite far often in interpreting legislation in this way to protect the press. And I think Andrew's got a very interesting example with bribery about how it's possible to interpret the legislation in such a way that there could be protection in the context where there is a real genuine public interest in possibly engaging in illegal activity in order to reveal possibly malpractice or some other kind of wrongdoing which the public should be informed about. But it puts a lot of onus on the courts to often be quite inventive in their interpretation, and on occasions it might not be possible for them to actually interpret the legislation in line with the Human Rights Act. And in that context, all they can do is give a declaration of incompatibility. Now, in the Leveson report, Lord Justice Leveson recognises this, but I think his view is that we can rely on prosecution guidelines. We don't need to be too concerned about this. The press, like everyone else, in a sense, runs the risk if they do something illegal, but because they are the media, there are safeguards. And the number of safeguards that he identifies are, first of all, the Crown Prosecution Service has now established prosecution guidelines for the press. And that recognises that in contexts where there is a sufficient case to go to court, there might be a public interest in actually not proceeding, not actually taking the case forward. But they will look at a number of factors, and they'll look at what they call the sort of criminality, the nature of the criminality of what the press has done. They'll look at whether there's been an element of corruption, whether this is a first offence, whether this is a repeated pattern of behaviour by the press, whether the press has been engaged in harassment or intimidation. He also mentions the scope for the jury, if it is a jury trial, for the jury not to convict. And he mentions that, obviously, the judge at the end of the day can take into account the position of the press in sentencing. My view is that this is not an adequate solution to the situation. I think these guidelines are extremely important and they're very helpful. And one of the points that we make in our paper is that to date, the prosecution system in Scotland has not yet developed anything like this. I think they are, to some extent, a reassurance to the press. But I can't see this as actually ceasing to put pressure on the press or creating a chilling effect, because at the end of the day, the press will not know whether or not the prosecution service are going to exercise their discretion in this way. They might have to go through the whole of a prosecution, and then they're hoping the jury are not going to convict. I think the better situation is to consider, in relation to each piece of legislation, whether the press should have some kind of public interest defence, or not the press, but the public in general, for reporting, however one wishes to define it, to deal with this. So I think my main concern is that there was a bit of a missed opportunity. Leveson decided that there should not be a general, certainly decided there should not be a general public interest defence. And I can see to some extent that that really does make sense. We already have the Human Rights Act. Would this legislation be entrenched? We don't have a system of entrenched legislation. So even if there were a general statute saying that the press should be afforded protection where they are engaged in genuine public interest investigation, I'm not sure that the general statute would have been the solution. But I do think, and as we will see with the examples, I think, later on, there are real cases of concern in this area. And the prosecution practice solution, I don't think, is the correct solution or the adequate solution to that. So I think that's probably more or less all that I want to say. I think there are aspects of Leveson that probably make good sense, but I think in terms of protection of the press, perhaps this was the wrong time for the press to be arguing this, but I think there are ongoing concerns about the patchwork of offences, the rather diverse way in which public interest offences have been identified, and I think this is something that really we could do better in addressing in the future.
Thank you very much, Rachel. Gavin?
First of all, just to say that if anyone wants the full paper from which I'm going to speak and hasn't had it, I don't think everyone got the circulated copies, just let me know and I can give you a hard copy or an electronic one. Since it's rather late in the day and energy levels could be flagging, I decided to sort of prepare as provocative and polemical a presentation as possible in the hope of fighting against our diminishing wills to continue. So I'm considering two issues. The first is the relationship that Leveson, as Leveson sees it, between individual free speech, press freedom, and the public interest. And I suggest here that Leveson sets out a perspective that's markedly at odds with that generally adopted by the press, and one which, if taken seriously, provides the principled underpinning for a system of regulation that should enhance rather than diminish the value of press freedom to the British public. And my second point deals with one of the more specific issues relating to the public interest, as that term, when that term is used as a justification for overriding other individual rights or interests such as privacy and reputation. I should make clear that I'm going to be very critical of the press when I talk about them. I'm talking about the main lines of arguments advanced by the press. There are honourable exceptions. The Guardian, for example, reaction to Leveson has been much more measured, and there are, of course, individual journalists who are much more intelligent and measured in their coverage of these issues, like Joshua. So I suggest in the paper that the press, in general, advances an argument or perception about the relationship between the individual right to free speech and the free press, which encourages us to see freedom of the press as a precious good that nothing must put at risk. The cure, by the way, if anyone still does think of press freedom as an unalloyed good, is simply to read some of the case studies in Volume 2 of Leveson about press intrusion, bullying, harassment, and systematic lying. It's become recently clear to me that there's really kind of two notions of press freedom floating around, one, I suppose, a sort of literal one, and one, a more a term of art. So I think when when the press cries foul at Leveson's threat to a free press, what it really means is that it wants to be free of any effective regulation, be able to operate with as much impunity as possible, relying on the inability or unwillingness of most people to use the expensive legal remedies in privacy and libel that are theoretically open to them. But the trope press freedom, as used in another way, in the kind of faux Churchillian style in which The Sun recently used it, is meant to evoke to its audience something different, not simply freedom from all constraints, but something that we really agree is a precious good, a press that's independent of state censorship, that fearlessly exposes corruption, abuse of power, and incompetence wherever it finds it, and that provides its audience with well-researched and accurate stories, enabling their self-development as individuals and participation in democratic self-government. So that ambiguity, I think, is constantly traded on. But going on, I think there's further difficulties with the claim of press freedom. The first is that it constantly invites us to assume that all speech in the press performs all the classical and valuable functions of speech, truth discovery, democratic deliberation, public accountability, and so on. Hence, any restraint on press freedom is a risk to democracy itself. Now, this might seem a manifestly absurd line of argument, but very senior judges have fallen for it. Leaving aside the entire US Supreme Court, let's, for example, note two judges in the highest court of appeal in New Zealand, who fell for this line of argument spectacularly in the Hosking and Runting case on the introduction of a common law right to privacy. These two judges opposed the introduction, any introduction of a tort of privacy, on the basis that press freedom was too precious a good to trifle with. And the fact that the noble purposes of free speech, which they enumerated, which included providing accountability for injustice, undemocratic practices, and the despoliation of human rights, had absolutely nothing at all to do with the kind of gutter celebrity journalism at which the tort was aimed, did not trouble the learned justices at all. Fortunately, they were in a minority, and New Zealand does now have a tort of privacy. I mentioned in the paper a more minor, but I think more entertaining, example from Leveson, of the Sunday Times solemnly pontificating about the brave lone stand of its fellow Murdoch title, The Sun, in standing up for all of our liberties by publishing the pictures of Prince Harry naked. So sincerely deluded are many journalists about the meaning of press freedom that I believe their faces were entirely straight, as they gravely compared the courage of the newspapers that defied the spy catcher ban with the courageous decision to print pictures of Prince Harry's naked rear end. So in short, then, the press-favoured first argument implicitly contends that we protect press freedom because of the vital contribution it makes to democratic deliberation and the holding of the powerful to account, and then uses this rationale to defend newspaper articles that make no such contribution at all, but consist instead of the salacious bullying of celebrities. The second step of the argument, having conflated celebrity gossip with democratic debate, is then to conflate press freedom as the simple equivalent of the individual right to freedom of expression, seeking, in other words, to treat the two as simple equivalents. Now, as I explained in the paper, and of course is well known amongst free speech lawyers, this step is also problematic, not least because some of the most important free speech rationales, such as autonomy and self-actualization of the speaker, may simply not be applicable to speech produced by media corporations at all. But as well as claiming the individual right to freedom of expression, journalists also, despite the contempt that many newspapers have for the European Convention on Human Rights and the Human Rights Act, take full advantage of their rights under Article 10 of the Convention, which I think is interpreted by Strasbourg, in fact, often does give more, is more protective of media freedom than of individual free speech as manifested in, for example, public protest or controversial artistic works. In fairness to Strasbourg, I should add that while the European Court does have a perhaps unfair regard for media freedom over individual free speech, it has, to its credit, largely exempted gossip journalism from this overly protective ambit. Although Strasbourg has caved in on this to some extent in its recent decision in Von Hanover No. 2, after a sustained campaign from media NGOs and their government supporters, alarmed that the first Von Hanover decision threatened to put a serious dent in the profits of gossip magazines and tabloid newspapers. So in short, the traditional stance of the press on this issue has been wholly self-serving and intellectually unsustainable. To demand all the rights that come from an individual speaker, while also laying enthusiastic claim to all the special privileges granted to them by law discussed today, such as journalistic materials, data protection, court reporting and the like. But at the same time as claiming these special responsibilities, they demur assuming any commensurate responsibilities, instead defending models such as the PCC and Lord Black's proposals to the Leveson, proposals fairly transparently designed to give the appearance of regulation while leaving newspapers able to act in grossly unethical ways with impunity. This, plus the current reaction to Leveson, of course, is wholly consistent with the history of attempts to regulate the press, in which a clear pattern of press resistance to any effective regulation is apparent, where concessions are only ever made in response to clear threats of government action and then amount to the least possible calculated to be necessary to buy off the threat of real change. Now, as I explain in the paper, a more satisfactory model for the relationship between individual free speech and press freedom than either the simple equivalence model or granting the media special blanket privileges is that proposed by Eric Berendt and glossed in my book with Helen Fenwick as what we called a variable geometry of free speech model. Under this approach, all media claims, whether for special privileges or simply for freedom of speech, such as those under the Data Protection Act, are examined rigorously in the lens of the free speech justifications, that is, the underlying reasons for valuing freedom of expression in the first place. Now, this model, it should be noted, upholds media freedom every bit as strongly as the press could desire, where the press is performing its proper function in a democracy, a question which is judged primarily by reference to audience interests, which, as Justice White argued in the US Red Line decision, are paramount when it comes to media freedom. Acceptance of this model tends, therefore, not only to allow a properly nuanced assessment of any particular claim to media freedom or privilege when it collides with another legally protected interest or regulatory requirement, but it also makes clear that the privileges granted to the press must be balanced with responsibilities, and it therefore allows for the imposition of specific regulation on the press with the aim of enhancing the quality of media speech from an audience perspective. So what did Leveson say about this? Well, aided by some thoughtful submissions, although it's a shame in relation to the ref that he didn't quote my own evidence in this regard, I think, he clearly rejected both the simplistic equivalence models and the self-serving press stance of wanting the best of all the models and the responsibilities of none of them. Leveson indeed rightly saw the press as Janus-faced. A free press, he said, contains within itself immense power to promote democratic freedoms and the public good. It also contains the reverse potential, that is to say, to create undemocratic concentrations of power and undermine freedoms and the public good. He found clearly that arguments claimed by individual speakers, such as autonomy and self-fulfillment, could not be claimed by the press, quoting Baroness O'Neill, who said, "Readers, listeners and viewers don't need media that express themselves. They need media that meets at least minimal standards for adequate communication with intended audiences." He also showed clear awareness that large sections of the press can often serve the search for truth, or its modern equivalent, the marketplace of ideas, rather poorly. This was perhaps unsurprising, given the numerous examples in the evidence he was given of the tendency of many newspapers nowadays to act not as purveyors of simple information, but rather as skilled propagandists, consciously using selective and misleading information to produce the desired impression with the public, and prepared even to repeat known inaccuracies over and over again, where they suit the newspaper's editorial line. So overall, Leveson's conclusion on this point was clear. The fundamental point, he said, is that unlike freedom of expression for individuals, which has intrinsic merit as a form of self-expression, freedom of the press is largely to be understood as an instrumental good, to be valued, promoted and protected to the extent that it's thereby enabled to flourish commercially as a sector and to serve its important democratic functions. Now, I think this is an important aspect of the reasoning of the report because it underpins the key argument for the new system, which is that far from threatening the real value of a free press, it should enhance it. Okay, my second and shorter point concerns what may be termed, what is sometimes termed and was referred to in your paper, as the economic survival argument for allowing the press to publish celebrity gossip, something that, as Leveson says, allows them to flourish commercially. Now, this argument is sometimes made when the press is being rather more honest, rather than pretending that all their output is majestic and serves the timeless goals of free speech. They're sometimes rather more brutally honest and say, essentially, look, you must permit us to have gutter celebrity coverage, even when it invades people's privacy, because the survival, the economic survival of newspapers depends upon it. Now, regrettably, this argument appears to receive some limited judicial support, most notoriously by Lord Wolfe in the Gary Flitcroft A&B case, where he said, "The courts must not ignore the fact that if newspapers do not publish information which the public are interested in, there will be fewer newspapers published, which will not be in the public interest." Similar comments were made in the Naomi Campbell case. Lady Hale said, "We need newspapers to sell in order to ensure that we have newspapers at all," while Lord Hoffman reminded us that we value the freedom of the press, but the press is a commercial enterprise and can flourish only by selling newspapers. Now, as I explained in the paper, there's nothing wrong with recognising that some journalism needs simply to entertain, and that newspapers, as Leveson said, often blend such entertaining journalism, with more serious coverage in a skillful way that may well successfully attract readers. Where I think the argument becomes extremely problematic is when it is used, as it was by Lord Wolfe, I think, in the Flitcroft case, to justify particular stories that intrude into people's private lives and appear otherwise to lack a specific public interest. The contention then becomes that the press must be allowed to publish worthless gossip that invades privacy because that makes the money that subsidises more valuable journalism. This argument is frequently repeated. And it could be made either in relation to a standards adjudication in future or, of course, in a privacy case in court as it has been. Now, I think there's two key objections to it. First of all, it should be recognised that it makes a factual claim about the world. It says, if X doesn't happen, then Y will happen. As such, it should be accompanied by at least some evidence, which I, however, have never seen adduced. While it's doubtless true that publishing celebrity gossip per se is very lucrative, I've never seen evidence to support the specific proposition that newspapers can only survive financially if they publish private information without the consent of the person concerned. Because there's, of course, a huge amount of celebrity gossip which is profitably published in the media on a purely consensual basis and is therefore unobjectionable. Second important point, however, is that even if the press are factually correct in making the argument that they do, which I doubt, it would still not justify tipping the balance in favour of press freedom in privacy cases, for this reason. The contention that the press should be allowed to invade people's privacy in order to make enough money to keep going means that the burden of ensuring that the general social good of having newspapers falls on that small minority of individuals whose privacy they invade. They are denied the remedy that they would otherwise be entitled to in order to ensure the ongoing existence of the press. Thus, this small group alone pays the cost. But if the existence of newspapers is an important social good from which everyone benefits, then everyone should contribute to it, not just the victims of gossip journalism. Now, the easiest way for everyone to contribute to it would be via the tax system or some other form of public subsidy. There's no reason why one small group in society should pay by having their private lives, their rights diminished and their private lives commodified in order to subsidise the media for the benefit of everyone else. So I think this is an important but deeply flawed argument concerning the public interest that should have been clearly rejected by Leveson. I think it's a pity that he did not do so, but I hope the courts will take the opportunity to do so at some point soon in the future. Thank you.
Yes, I think probably as the format we've adopted suggests, and maybe something of a changeling in the public interest nest. If that is the case, however, it's entirely my fault, and that the paper I originally promised to Jake was to be focused precisely upon this concept of a general or a generic public interest defence. Maybe if I can be allowed to say a word or two about that theme, following on from what Rachel said to say. As Rachel said, Lord Justice Leveson receives really quite a lot of evidence suggesting the need for such a defence. And in his discussion on point, he, as it happens, he focused a lot on the Bribery Act. Now, in talking specifically about the Sun's exposure of a guy called Munir Patel, who was a corrupt magistrates court official, he suggested that a case in which was the first prosecution under the Bribery Act, a case in which the journalists made a payment and promised a second payment, and thereby, in principle at least, fell foul of the requirements set out in Section 1 of the Bribery Act and could have faced prosecution. And considering that, Lord Justice Leveson suggested that it was inconceivable that such a prosecution would ever be brought. Okay. And as Rachel suggested further, he offered other reasons to be sanguine about the position of journalists faced with potential prosecution under various different criminal statutes. He emphasised the discretion of the Crown Prosecution Service, and he said even if a prosecution were brought in such circumstances, there are other safeguards that one might expect to be brought into play. He cited the judicial capacity to dismiss cases. He talked about the prospect of reverse verdicts or sympathetic acquittals. And he also talked about the means by which judges could be lenient in exercising their sentencing discretion. I have to say that I think I'm with Rachel on this. I mean, I think that while those safeguards may, in all practical cases, be effective, as a matter of principle, they aren't enough. And it seems to me that where a journalist is engaged in behaviours that are furthering the public interest, are pursued only for those purposes, those are activities which we should be positively encouraging, rather, or at least be neutral about, rather than being sceptical and punitive about. And therefore, if something is desirable in society, if it's not morally blameworthy, it shouldn't be criminal. Okay. I think Gavin Miller, talking about this a few weeks ago, was referring to the golden met wand of the law as being very much preferable to the exercise of administrative discretion, and I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, for me, then, the debate really should be focusing in upon whether we're talking about an individual statute or in terms of a general or generic defence, we should be focusing in on the criteria or the requirements or the gateway features of such defences on which one might refer to sorts of things we're already seeing, the Data Protection Act, or maybe, as Rachel mentioned, the guidance published by the DPP, you know, which give us really quite developed and interesting and sustainable arguments as to when culpability shouldn't be attached to behaviour. I mean, I should add to that more generally before I go on and start talking about payment for sources that we've had a lot of discussion today about good journalists and bad journalists and you know, specific illustrations offered, personifications of that. I must say that, I mean, maybe to disturb what seemed to me to be quite a cosy consensus on the point, I was going to say shatter, but maybe that's a bit melodramatic, you know. I think there's something in the comments which are being offered by journalists and newspapers about the risks of Leveson. Now, of course, Leveson and his proposals don't usher in the apocalypse, but actually there is something in the concerns which are being raised by people. And I certainly wouldn't share Hugh's view as to the, well, what he seemed to present, or scepticism at the, you know, the vapid, what he considered to be the vapid claim being made in the Daily Mail or elsewhere in the newspapers about risks posed by various of Leveson's proposals. And in those, I would include sorts of things that were being discussed in one of our earlier sessions on data protection and potentially on sources. So I think that there are risks to journalism here which we shouldn't simply ignore, that we need to be cautious of, and to be sure that what comes out of the various different negotiation and policy development is appropriate, given the risks of babies and bathwaters and so on. Anyway, coming back to my paper then, as was suggested, the focus here is on payment of sources, and that's really the avenue by which I came to this topic. I don't plan to speak to the paper, as many of you have pointed out in quiet conversation to me. It's a very long paper. I must say it was good fun to prepare it, you know. But essentially what I have are four reflections upon the potential application of the Bribery Act to the journalism context and the emergence of this law as it's to be applied to journalism. And really what I propose to do is to focus on those four reflections. I should say that this is very much paper in development. I'm not sure of the arguments that I'm presenting in this paper. There is something of a cognitive dissonance between two of the different arguments, two of the four points. That is, if one is correct, the other one is incorrect, and vice versa. But I'll hopefully test them on you. More generally, though, in terms of the Leveson consideration of checkbook journalism or payments of sources, of course you'll be familiar with the idea that payments were one of the primary features of the malpractice which were exposed to the phone hacking scandal and what's happened subsequently. And Lord Justice Leveson does in his report, and certainly did in his inquiry, reflect upon these issues. You're probably familiar with the idea, but less not, I'll reiterate it, that he wasn't able to do as much as he had hoped to do in this regard, in terms of understanding, you know, who gave what to whom and why, because of the concurrence of the criminal proceedings under Operation Elfdom. So the idea was that Leveson's consideration of this theme would be relegated to part two of the inquiry and query, you know, whether that will ever happen. He did, however, offer, you know, 10 or 12 pages discussion about, you know, the phenomenon of checkbook journalism in his discussions. And one of the salient points of that discussion for me was the idea that he didn't recommend that checkbook journalism should be prohibited or prescribed. Okay? I mean, he seemed to recognise that there was a value in information which, all other things being equal, you know, could perfectly reasonably be marketized. He did highlight, you know, potential problems with markets for information in the context of journalism, and he trotted out you know, various complaints about, you know, the ramifications or the repercussions of payments, which are familiar in certain journalism ethics literature. So, in particular, he was emphasizing, you know, the risks of exaggeration or fabrication by sources when encouraged by the prospect of payment. He also suggested that we might foment the market for information, and by doing so, actively encourage, for example, increased invasion of privacy in order to get the information which is subsequently remunerated. Okay? Perfectly reasonable points and arguments which would justify some movement towards regulation of this practice. He also highlighted a third point. I mean, he explicitly said he was going to make two points, and then in his conclusion, he made a third point, which is interesting and important, which is the idea that actually what's going on here is that journalists, by engaging in payment, are outsourcing criminal behaviour. So they're passing on potential liability to other people who form payment are willing to bear the risk of criminal repercussions, which is quite powerful, I thought, you know. And obviously the backdrop to it is very much the concept of, you know, the industrial scale of such invasions of privacy and potential possible criminal misbehaviours. Traditionally, there have been a number of areas in which, notwithstanding the general legitimacy of you know, trade and information, there have been justifications for regulating and, in some cases, legally prescribing behaviours. Those have been payments to public officials and some others, payments to witnesses in criminal proceedings, payments to criminals for accounts of their misdeeds and so on, and fairly latterly, payments to children or children's parents regarding issues which might have a bearing on their welfare, which is regulated by the PCC in the wake of the Elfie Patton story, which I must say, in searching this paper, is quite the most appalling instance of tabloid stroke source interaction that one could possibly imagine. Now, the child's father was the guy who sold the story. His mother was also paid. It's just a farrago once you delve into it, which is really quite disturbing and certainly warrants regulatory oversight. Of course, in the past, what we've had is general laws, such as the Prevention of Corruption Act 1906, which at least in principle apply to bribery or corrupt practices, within which category you can draw checkbook journalism, insofar as, for example, you have the payment of a police officer. And certainly the arrests which have been pursued under Operation Elfden have been made both on the basis of misconduct in a public office, the common law offence of misconduct in public office, and the 1906 Act. As it happens, any charges that have been laid, and certainly the convictions which have been found, have been based only upon the common law offence. And one of the things that got me interested in this was why that was the case. Why had the statutory option been jettisoned? Now, I suspect that that's just a matter of convenience. It's more likely that the prosecution would be successful, and therefore the DPP has taken that choice. But I wondered, and I say, it was this sort of sense of intrigue about that which motivated me to start looking at this. Anyway, for the future, the Bribery Act will be the relevant piece of legislation. And what I was doing in the main body of this work was just thinking about how the Bribery Act would apply in light of this general understanding that there is no explicit public interest defence available in the Act. And the first question I was asking myself was, well, how did that happen? I mean, the media lobby, as we've seen, has been very effective and very focused upon legal proposals that may well have a bearing upon their activities. So it just seems strange to me that this had come to pass without, it seemed to me, very much of a murmur about it. And when I investigated, I mean, you need to understand that the Bribery Act has come about after like a very protracted legislative period. I mean, there were earlier versions of proposed legislation which fell by the wayside. So we really had about a 10 or 12 year pre-legislative period of consideration on this legislation. Ultimately resulting in a piece of legislation which provides very general prescriptions within which juries are expected to lump certain forms of behaviour. So there's an awful lot of emphasis placed upon the good sense or common sense of the jury to understand what should and what should not be prohibited behaviour. Anyway, during this legislative process you had a Law Commission investigation, a Joint Committee review on a draft bribery bill, and then obviously the legislative process itself in Parliament. And at no point does it seem that the media offered formal responses to any of this consultation. Okay? And that struck me as enormously curious. So either it seemed to me that the media just missed this as a potential threat to its practice, or it decided for its own reasons not to engage with the policy debate. Or alternatively, it did engage with the policy debate, but did so sotto voce, which is in fact what happened. So there was lobbying on this point, which speaks very much to Jake's paper of earlier, but it was perpetuated, if you like, through what's become known as the University of Leeds nexus between Paul Dacre and Jack Straw as Minister for Justice, I think it was. So that was the first curiosity. The second idea was then why there isn't a public interest defence in there. And in looking at it, I mean, there certainly isn't an explicit public interest defence, but in looking at it, it seemed to me that it is potentially possible to argue a public interest type argument for a court and hope that might be successful. And to understand why that might be, I think you need to understand what the prescriptions are, and I apologise for very briefly going into some technical legal detail, but I've presented the prescriptions relevant to the payor under Section 1 on the screen there. But in essence, what's required is the offer of a financial or other advantage to a person in the under Case 1, in the hope of inducing or rewarding improper performance of the relevant function or activity. So these are all the terms of the prescription, which, as I say, are not legal terms or terms of law. They're other factual determinations to be made by the jury. Okay. So in looking at the legislation, I was thinking, well, there isn't an explicit public interest defence there for journalists or others, but one might argue before a jury that it should not be considered the improper performance of a relevant function or activity to release information on some malpractice, you know, in one's workplace, for example. Okay, so you would be relying there upon the jury finding that the elements of the prescription, the elements of the offence, had not in fact been proven, rather than unseating a prima facie finding that the criminal behaviour had been perpetrated. The problem with this, or one potential problem with this, is that fits nicely with Case 1. But there's a second variant of the bribery offence, which is described as Case 2, also to be found in Section 1. And there, there's a slightly different emphasis. What's required in that context is that payment is made in the knowledge or belief that receipt of the payment would amount to the improper performance of the relevant function. And on its face, it looks to me as if, it's more of a stretch to ask a jury to think that a public official, let's say a police officer, can ever receive payment with regard to the performance of their functions in order that they do something other than strictly what is expected of them. So in trying to get around that problem and trying to divine a public interest defence, I came up with a few suggestions here. I mean, one thing, having spoken to the relevant law commissioner, the guy who effectively developed the law almost single-handedly, one thing is the idea that Case 2 was introduced for other reasons. Okay. It was introduced to encompass the situation where somebody performs a public function in good faith, give somebody a visa, subsequently meets the person whom they give a visa, and they said, thanks for that, mate, here's £1,000. Acceptance at that point of £1,000 is improper performance under the bill, and that case is intended to capture that. Okay. However, as I say, on its face, it looks as if it would also capture payment of a police officer for the illicit release of information. I'm short of time at this point, but the hope would be that you would be able to introduce, say, a public interest defence in inverted commas on that basis. The expectation that would be successful before the court is still, it's conjecture. I'm out of time, but the last two points then focus upon something which is a personal bugbear for me, which is the question about the failure of Parliament to introduce a statutory prohibition around the turn of the millennium on payments to witnesses, particularly in criminal proceedings. Okay. And that was a matter which was effectively left to the PCC to regulate. And it seemed to me that one way of interpreting the Bribery Act would be if you could understand the position of the witness in criminal proceedings to be the performance of a function of a public nature, which is then discussed in the paper. If you could understand that performance to be or that has to be met, then conceivably, inadvertently, without any discussion, Parliament may have introduced a statutory prohibition of the behaviour that had formerly been left after much consideration to the self-regulatory sphere. The final point then was essentially this idea of whether, in fact, the Bribery Act is likely to be deployed in the context of payment sources. And I give two arguments as to whether that's likely or not. In one case, which is essentially prosecutorial preference for the common law offence. If that's the reason why the 1906 Act wasn't used, it's easier to get a conviction under the common law. You might expect that to continue. If the explanation was that the 1906 Act was overly complicated and difficult and troublesome to deploy, the same might not be true of the Bribery Act, in which case you might expect the Bribery Act to be deployed.